This is both got a positive and negative side here in this slide. So the talk, which centers around the ideas of cosmological collider physics and related things that come up as you start going down the path of how much you can mine cosmological correlators for what they would tell us about inflation or very high scale physics, it's when you discover that mechanism, it's kind of this eye-opening thing in that you can see all your dreams as a high-energy physicist coming true experimentally, and that's sort of what I'm going to mean by the extreme particle physics that's there. But it is also taking place at the intersection with extreme cosmology. It involves, say, the inflationary era. It also involves a lot of, if you're going to do it as a experimental science, any of the ideas that are discussed here, it will take extreme cosmology in the sense of extreme precision in experiments, extreme precision in calculation of all of the standard model or post-Big Bang effects that would be larger than the kind of effects that we're looking for here. So I kind of pursued it, and with my collaborators, who you'll see, in sort of various levels of realism. So one is there's just this incredible thing about inflationary space-time and field theory and inflationary space-time. And so it's like, what could I do with that? And charting out what ideas you could pursue in this dream world where you had access to the correlations that would tell us about particles in the very, very early universe at very, very high energies. But then there are two layers of coming down to Earth. One is sort of course, any grand idea you have should at least be consistent with the data that we already have and how well we've understood it, like how well we've understood the CMB and so on. So there's some set of constraints on any idea, however exotic, just by the data that we already have. And so there, since I am not a very good cosmologist, it's just you want some simple guardrails that keep you from saying anything too insane. And so there are some basic guidelines that we follow. And then finally, the thing that maybe, as I said, the hardest is that if any of these very ambitious directions that I'll talk about are to ever see the light of day, to actually be experimentally verified, it would require a Herculean effort on the side of real cosmologists to be able to, in some sense, wind the clock in these primordial fluctuations back to the time soon after inflation, where we could see the effects that I'm going to talk about in stark relief. Okay, so there I'll have less to say. I'll just give you the vaguest hint of what you're fighting against in terms of natural limits or physical limits, just only staying vaguely realistic about what humans can do. Okay, just ballpark so that I don't say anything that is absolutely laughable, but you could still laugh. Okay, so I wasn't quite sure what the audience was because Curly insists that there are no groups and subgroups at PI. Anyway, so let me just show the obligatory thing, but it'll at least guide our eye. So here is the theory of inflation as it's sort of in a cartoon form, that if we didn't have inflation and we just had the Big Bang, and this is sort of the co-moving horizon, that is to say, if you look at co-moving length scales, or you look at length scales in this direction, they are in causal contact if they're south of this blue line, and out of causal contact if they are north of this blue line. And so there are some modes that we would see in the CMB, or some length scales, like from there to there, that we would see in the CMB, that would have been out of causal contact all the way to the Big Bang, which is surprising if you realize that they are at almost thermal equilibrium. And inflation is introduced to solve that problem by diverting the co-moving horizon in this way so that all these length scales that the CMB accesses, for example, were in causal contact in the inflationary era. More for the point of what we now use inflationary theory for is that quantum fluctuations during inflation would actually populate interesting modes on different wavelengths, on different scales, that basically exit the horizon and freeze. They are now not causally changing. They, however, then re-enter the horizon. And we could say that once they re-enter the horizon, we could say they thaw. That will be maybe more meaningful, well, in the sense that the CMB is not just seeing what these original quantum fluctuations, but has processed them in famous ways. By the time the CMB takes place, takes the photograph of the universe, and that's what we can see today, okay? It also has modes, and this will be relevant later. There are also modes that we can see that are snapshotted by the CMB, but at the time of the CMB, these modes have not yet entered the co-moving horizon, and yet by today we can see them because they have entered the horizon, okay? But at the time of the CMB, there hasn't been a lot of thawing, so we're literally getting a photograph of this, you know, with a nice frozen image of what was the primordial modes, okay? Okay, so the idea behind cosmological collider physics and sort of the bag of things that I will talk about is based on the idea that these quantum fluctuations, of course, quantum fluctuations are good at creating particles. So you could have particle creation in the inflationary era, and there could be some way of recording it. Maybe if they decay to the inflaton, then these quantum fluctuations or particle production could be recorded and then show up in the CMB or in large scale structure or whatever, okay? And the question is, what would you see? And the budget for particle creation, naively, the E equals MC squared to create heavy particles, that's where it's exciting to plug in the numbers, is of course given by some time varying something. And in this case, it's the expansion of the universe is providing a kind of energy scale, the Hubble parameter during inflation, which I'll usually just call H, will be the Hubble scale during inflation, could be, given say the constraints from the Planck data, could be as big as this enormous energy scale, which is 10 orders of magnitude above the LHC energies. And so we could have particle creation of super, super heavy particles there. And it'd be amazing if particle physics at these incredible scales could somehow be recorded and we could decode that, okay? Just to sort of continue at the cartoon level, this is what I'll sort of want for vanilla slow roll inflation. We'll talk about variance. But the usual sort of inflationary picture in slow roll is that there's a scalar field, the inflaton, and it's rolling slowly here, so that you have an approximately constant vacuum energy. And that's responsible for bending the co-moving horizon in the way shown in the previous slide. And then after some time, it stops slowly rolling, and if you want, reheats or decays into the standard model and dark matter and whatever else there is in the post-Big Bang era. And that's the classical picture, but then the quantum picture, the quantum fluctuations, can be viewed as the quantum fluctuations of this inflaton field about its sort of classical limit, which is just the same. It's a completely homogeneous limit where every point in the universe is got the ball at the same place, but quantum mechanically that's impossible. So there are fluctuations set by the Hubble parameter, and very crudely, they give rise to temperature fluctuations in the CMB or in density perturbations in large-scale structure, roughly dependent on the velocity of the field here in the following sense, that as quantum effects perturb phi, and so it goes a little advanced or a little slower depending on whether you're here or there, that turns into a time of reheating that can differ between here and here, depending on whether the ball is a little advanced or a little retarded. And so we can use this phi dot as the currency exchange rate to tell you the time of reheating delay in different places. And that turns into the temperature of the CMB, crudely, right, in different places. So anyway, when you fit to the CMB, you find that the velocity, so this will be one important number to keep in mind, that the velocity, and I'm being very sloppy about rounding everything off for the purpose of the talk, but this velocity of the scalar field of the inflaton has to be of order 10 to the 4 Hubble squared, okay? Or the square root of that is like 60 Hubble, okay? Now, during this time, where you have an approximately constant vacuum energy and the kinetic energy is smaller than the potential energy, that's the slow roll part, the gravitational back reaction to that is an inflating space-time or approximately a de Sitter phase of the universe. And so here is the usual de Sitter metric with the exponentially expanding universe. But it'll be useful for us to use conformal coordinates, which where this eta, as you can see, is really just the log of t. Sorry, the exponential of t. So eta is the exponent e to the minus ht. And then we can write it in this way, where conformal time goes, instead of going from t, going from minus infinity to infinity, goes from minus infinity to zero. Okay, so t equals infinity is eta equals zero. And of course, we have still got translational invariance, at least in these co-moving coordinates, and therefore co-moving momenta are conserved. But since we have a time dependence in the metric, we've broken time translation invariance, but the vestige of time translation invariance is that you simultaneously shift the time as long as you rescale space, okay? Or if you want, you rescale both eta and x, and this is obviously a symmetry of this metric. Now, we want to think of the entire inflationary era in this idealized form as de Sitter space-time. And in a sense, this final thing, that the final act, which kicks off the rest of the Big Bang, the reheating of the Standard Model and dark matter, we want to think of that as late time. That is to say, t approximately infinity, to say it in the crudest approximation, or eta equals zero. And so this spatial, this symmetry, this vestige of time translations, this symmetry becomes simpler at eta equals zero because this becomes trivial. And so we just have the symmetry of scale invariance, just in terms of, right, fixing eta, and then it's just scale invariance in space. And that gives rise to the prediction that any quantum fluctuation, whatever you're looking at, whatever the form of, the detail form of these quantum fluctuations and quantum correlators, that they will be scale invariant. They will be scale invariant as functions of x, or if you want, scale invariant as functions of k, the wave vectors. Obviously, as most of you know, there's a lot of deviation, even in the data, and certainly theoretically, from this idealized picture of inflation. And a lot of the excitement of the data is to follow those deviations. However, in this talk, we are going to be shooting for very small effects, okay? So we don't want to calculate at order small squared. So for the purpose of the talk, you should have this more cartoon vision, which is also easier for me as a non-cosmologist, which is that it's de Sitter space. We don't worry about the fact that the slowly rolling thing has introduced a deviation from scale invariance and the tilt of the power spectrum and so on. Because we're already going to be calculating something small. So that's the going rate. Okay, so it'll be easier to think in this kind of stylized or idealized picture. Okay, so here is the central two slides on particle creation in de Sitter space at the technical level. And so here is a heavy particle, which I'm trying to be uniform in the talk. I'm calling sigma. It's not the inflaton, it's some other heavy particle. And so here's the usual heavy particle the free heavy particle, but coupled to gravity, so in de Sitter space-time. So if I plug in the metric for de Sitter space in these conformal coordinates, then I just get this after I Fourier transform space. So I'm working in mixed space, mixed momentum real time, okay? Taking advantage of translation invariance in space, but there's not much to be gained since I don't have translation invariance in time. Okay, so that's that. And then the equations of motion turn out to be of Bessel type, easily worked out. And so here is sort of the solution, okay? It's given in particular by this Hankel function for the following, it's that particular combination of Bessel functions for the following reason. That if I go to, and to make this as simple as possible, I'm just, not because you have to, but just for simplicity, let's consider that M is somewhat higher mass than Hubble. Okay, so even though we think Hubble is the energy of our energy source, we're going to shoot for something which is a little bit heavier than that, not much heavier. Okay, then we can approximate these Hankel functions as so I can obviously drop the 9/4 there if I'm keeping that, but basically this is sort of the approximate form in obviously here. But there are two limits to consider. We can go very early. Early, remember, is eta getting large and negative. And if we go very early, then the solution to the field equation looks like this. And the choice of Hankel over any other combination of Bessel functions is because at early times, I have what looks like positive energy waves. And you don't see any effect of the mass, but that's understandable. If you go early enough, all momenta are blue shifted. So you're insensitive to the mass. So it just looks like a massless field, standard in Minkowski space, a kind of massless field, but with positive energies. Okay, so that makes sense. Nothing strange from our standard field theory training. However, if I go to late times, right, where eta is small, then instead of getting this sort of relativistic looking plane wave, I get a kind of massive oscillation, e to the minus imt, which is to say the particle is essentially at rest. Easy to understand. All of its momentum has sort of been redshifted away. And so that makes sense. But then there is this odd guy out. It looks like the same thing, except it's got negative energy. Okay, and there's a suppressed amplitude for this. But this negative energy, from a first quantized perspective, right, whatever, quantum field theory prior to 1930 or something, would be a disaster, right? This is a terrible thing. How are we getting negative energies when we started with positive energies? Bad things have happened. And of course, we know the answer to that. It's basically the first quantized clue that at second quantized level, you have pair creation going on. So of course, what's really happening is that as we go between these two regimes, right, eta of order m over k, that you really have an amplitude to create a pair. And the amplitude is given by this coefficient here. Okay, so that's this e to the minus pi m. And I'm now in units, for the rest of the talk, unless I explicitly say otherwise, I'm in units where Hubble of the inflationary scale is 1. Okay, that's my units. So this thing here is often called a Boltzmann suppression, which is more intuitively obvious why that's the name. If you square the amplitude for the probability, and then notice that in De Sitter space, there's a Hawking temperature, which is Hubble over, well, of order Hubble, over 2 pi. And if I think of that as a kind of temperature, this h over 2 pi is a kind of temperature, then this is clearly a kind of Boltzmann suppression. When the mass is bigger than the temperature, I'm Boltzmann suppressed. So there's something vaguely said. We're not in global De Sitter space. We're in an inflationary space-time, which is the Poincaré patch of De Sitter space. But for large mass, it's basically this, that the Hawking temperature of De Sitter space is creating particles. And if the particle mass is too high, then the probability of doing that is Boltzmann suppressed. So it's quite intuitive in that sort of way of thinking about it. Okay, so in order to make this talk go faster, I have to say, yeah, that's my doing second quantization on the cheap, okay, by just writing field equations and doing first quantization. But of course, we're supposed to do second quantization. And basically, we're going to be studying cosmological correlators where the correlators are due to the inflaton having quantum fluctuations inside it. And so the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton tell you the timing of reheating, okay? And that becomes an observable thing in the temperature fluctuations. So here are quantum fluctuations of the inflaton, and we're doing even non-Gaussian correlators, things which are beyond 2 point. And why would they have non-Gaussian correlations? Because somehow they're interactions that the inflaton is party to. So they look like this. And so things that are of practical interest, like temperature fluctuations, say, how would we calculate them? We'd have to calculate them with some sort of Feynman diagram involving these things. And the only thing that's sort of interesting is that we are stuck as observers. We're not doing S-matrix type processes where we design the incoming state and we specify the outgoing state and it's all on shell. Instead, we are only in charge of the sort of asking about questions at this reheating time, eta approximately zero. And in that sense, we are specifying our observable here. And then we are calculating expectations in the state of the universe, okay? Which is given by taking some perturbative approximation to the vacuum, where by vacuum I mean that any mode that you go far enough into the past should only have positive energies, just like the Minkowski vacuum, the so-called Bunch-Davies vacuum. And this I epsilon does the usual thing that it does also in Minkowski space. It By introducing a little bit of Euclidean time evolution, it projects you onto the interacting vacuum rather than the Fock vacuum, okay? And it has to be done both on this side and this side because you're calculating expectations in this Bunch-Davies state. That means that there are things that are annoying for flat space field theorists, like there is anti-time evolution on this side and time evolution on this side, and when you pull interaction terms out, you can get them from this side or this side rather than the usual time-ordered perturbation theory that we're familiar with. But it's a bunch of diagrams, and I will give you the cartoon version of all of these only in this talk, although one can just do the calculations. Okay, so that allows you to calculate things like a three-point function and then go into Fourier space, at least in space, not in time. And that defines a kind of what's called a bispectrum once you strip off the fact that co-moving momenta are conserved. So we can throw that trivial thing out. OK, so then there's just one other convention to keep track of, that non-Gaussianity, rather than the bispectrum, it is often described by a kind of normalized bispectrum called F, which is given by this phi dot classical, the 10 to the fourth thing that I talked about at the beginning of the talk, the bispectrum, and then normalized by the sort of the power spectrum, which at this level of approximation, you're dropping little fine touches that you normally would learn about, which is like the mixing of the scalar inflaton with the scalar modes of the metric, and so on. All of these are higher order. And so at our cartoon level, it's just doing scalar field theory in a fixed space-time background, okay? And the primes are just dropping delta functions, okay? And again, this is a very interesting function conceptually because it's a function of these three wave numbers, wave vectors, but they have to form a triangle. That's momentum conservation. And to the extent that you have scale invariance, then it's not even a function of triangles. It's a function of shapes of triangles, because you can rescale the whole thing. So it's a weird, it's a beautiful thing. Out of a very practical question, you get a function of shapes. And there's a quick, for our purposes, a quick way of saying, well, this is a whole function. How big is it? What's the going rate? Because at some point, you have to measure these things, and you want to know whether you're on the right or wrong side of what is possible. So you can sort of take the equilateral shape just as a quick reference size. And so that's this FNL. And basically, the data that we already have from the CMB tells us that the world is not very non-Gaussian, or at least the CMB is not very non-Gaussian. How do I know that? Because I just said less than order 10. Because you can see that in some sense, the only overall big number in this definition here, this is sort of non-Gaussian versus Gaussian, but it's this thing, and that's the 10 to the 4. So if you had a maximally non-Gaussian theory, it would look like an FNL of 10 to the 4, but the data tells us that we have a pretty Gaussian world out there. The inflaton, if inflation is even correct, is just not interacting that much. Okay. The final little part of the intro would be, well, a very extended intro, don't worry, is that the interaction could be mediated by this heavy particle sigma that I just talked about earlier, that the interaction between inflatons could be mediated by that. So we can consider a simple kind of interaction of the heavy particle to the inflaton, where the inflaton is derivatively coupled, which helps maintain the radiative stability of a field that has almost no potential, that it's almost a very flat potential during the inflationary phase. And that makes it renormalizable, so there's some scale that has to cut that off, which we'll talk about. And now, if I just plug this in, there are some factors that we can quickly guess without having to do the full calculation. There's this phi dot here, because I don't actually need to do a four-point function for the exchange of a scalar. I can take one of the legs and just put it to the classical slow-rolling homogeneous field. And so that's that guy, and so it gets dotted into a phi dot. There's two powers of lambda because I used the interaction twice. What's happening here is that if I can think of this as having a time t late and this is a time t early where this happened, then this particle is just propagating, the heavy particle is propagating from t late to from t early to t late. And we know that it first has to be created. So the idea is that one part of the pair is sort of getting eaten up by this interaction, and the other one, I'm allowing it, we'll see how, I'm allowing it to propagate for a long time, and that's this factor here. And the price of pair creation is the Boltzmann suppression, okay? Now, how do I allow it to propagate for a long time? In the following way, we see the following kinematics, that once you've created this, if I want to delay that guy from decaying, so it has a long time before it decays, so I have a long time period to watch this heavy particle, then this, the time at which the pair creation happens, is given by this result that came out of that, just looking at the asymptotics of the Hankel function, right? This is the time on which pair creation takes place. But I want to delay this time. And the way to do it is to take these K1 and K2 to be much larger than K3. That is to say, the so-called squeeze limit, where these two are long and this is short. Okay? And the reason is, if these two are hard momenta compared to this, is that for the chi to decay kinematically, it should go, just thinking in some locally Minkowskian reference frame, the particle chi should go into two inflatons with essentially back-to-back, because K1 and K2 are hard relative to K3, so they're essentially back-to-back. But the physical momentum in K has to be the co-moving momentum multiplied by this redshift of the co-moving momentum. So in order for this decay to take place, it has to be that this K hard, K1 or K2, K hard times eta should equal M. That fixes a time. If I'm looking in my cosmological correlators, I get to choose what K1, K2, K3 I'm observing, that when I choose K hard, I'm basically choosing a time by solving this equals this. Okay. So in other words, if I just take this thing I wrote in real time and just plug in this kinematics, it says that this time dependence, the thing I'd love to see, I would love to see this primordial super heavy particle actually just moving, like watching the movie of a dinosaur, right? And the way I get it, if I just plug this relationship for time and KK into here, I get this, okay? So I get a correlator which has no time in it, kind of a vaguely time holography being done here, which is that I am seeing time dependence secretly, but, and I can scan the time dependence by taking K soft over K hard in an increasingly squeezed limit. Okay, And in that way, I'm secretly seeing this. And this is a non-analytic function of the wave vectors, which makes it a little more distinctive than other contributions to non-Gaussianity.
Okay. So is it kinds is sigma?
Yes, because I had to change, because I wrote too many papers and they all changed names, mm-hmm. I tried to fix it up. This should be sigma. This should be sigma. Sorry. Yes, yes. Okay, so here is, I know that that was mostly the introduction, but let me just say quickly here, I'm doing very cartoon version of a few interesting things, which is, one, you have this amazing mechanism that's out there. What's worth seeing? And so, you know, you're at such incredible energies, could you see anything about grand unification? And that's what I want to talk about. There's inflation itself is a tricky thing. It's a tricky mechanism to get right. So you could ask, is there a way of probing inflation? And there I at least just have a quick word to say. We at least see one way of probing some of the associated particles with inflation. One of the first things that we did, actually chronologically, was just studying gauge theories using this mechanism, in particular gauge theories with the Higgs mechanism, like the Standard Model. But it's always a desperate game in terms of signal strength and not getting killed by Boltzmann suppression. Okay, so these are two reasons why it's a desperate game. And so I've worked on mechanisms in which you're trying to get stronger signals, as well as ameliorating the Boltzmann suppression. Okay, so I want to talk about that. And then the last thing, if I have time, would be the thing I've actually been doing more recently, which is using a different type of map. Ask for, like, we have the CMB, that's a map, primordial map. Large-scale structure, galaxy distributions, that's a large scale, that's a primordial map. 21 centimeter cosmology, high redshift cosmology in the far future, that's a map. But I'm a little obsessed with the idea that one finds better maps, better from the point of view of something I'll talk about later. And a possible map, in a very futuristic sense, are maps involving stochastic gravitational waves rather than photons, rather than CMB photons. Gravitational waves. Okay. Okay. So the dumb idea first up is, can you see grand unification? Well, let's just do non-supersymmetric grand unification. So if I just take the Standard Model gauge couplings or the inverse of the Standard Model gauge couplings that we've measured, and I evolve them with the renormalization group, then we at least see this level of apparent meeting. If you'd never heard of SUSY and you'd never heard of any, say, SUSY sales pitches, just this would say that's oddly close to coincidence. Okay, that's the data, right? And you would have already therefore been inspired by the ideas of grand unification, which, as you know, both help explain the strange quantum numbers of the Standard Model matter fields, basically by taking the two weak isospins and the three colors and unifying them, say, to SU5 or something bigger like SO10, and assuming that there's a grand Higgs mechanism at energies around here that breaks you down to the Standard Model, okay? And it leaves you with two questions at this level. So this could be happening without supersymmetry. What's exciting is that that kind of vagues, we don't know exactly where it is, but it could be exactly in the ballpark of high-scale inflation, in which case maybe we could directly, not wait for protons to decay or any of that, just directly go and produce particles related to grand unification. There are a couple of issues. Standard GUTS, the original GUTS theories, grand unified theories, had proton decay mediated by particles that show up as in this grand, you know, basically extra gauge bosons that are made massive by this Higgs mechanism, and they could mediate proton decay, and the bounds on those are severe. They seem to suggest masses higher than the scales that the cosmological collider could shoot for. And then there's this little question of if this is the right theory, then why aren't they meeting perfectly, right? And both things can be answered with a very simple kind of grand unified theory called orbifold GUTS, which is a kind of baby version of string unification. Okay, so even there is a kind of unification that is particular to string theories, and in terms of its sort of the feel of it, you can just do it with extra dimensions, and that's what orbifold guts is. And the idea is very simple, which is you have a higher dimension, so let's say it's an interval, very microscopic interval, and you have your higher your unified and higher dimensional grand unified theory with fermions and gauge theory. And of course, wherever there's space-time, there's five-dimensional gravity. And how do you break why don't we see the unified theory? Very simple, it's the boundary conditions. The boundary conditions violate the grand unified symmetry down to 3-2-1. But there is a way to do this. I won't go into it, but there's a way to do this as a mechanism in this very simple way of doing things where you protect the baryon number. So proton decay is not a prediction of this variant of grand unified theories. So one of our exercises in just pushing around cosmological collider physics was to just add the inflaton living localized on the one boundary, so it's just a four-dimensional field. And it causes these, what look like these transverse directions, three-dimensional space, to expand, right, or accelerate.
So in this model, all heavy fields, they all get the similar masses of 10 to 13 GeV? I mean, everything beyond the model, we have these masses, or
yeah.
We have something lighter?
No. So they're all the new physics is all sitting at 10 to the 13 GeV. Right? So there's nothing in this minimal model, there's nothing for some LHC or a person to see. And so what kind of things could you look for? Well, you could look for some of these heavy gauge bosons that have masses of order the gut scale. And for reasons you'll see later, I've chosen like the Z prime of B minus L. But there's another thing even more exotic sitting here, because if the extra dimension is implicated in grand unification, there has to be Kaluza-Klein excitations of the graviton, okay? And that's even more exotic spin 2 guy. So I'm gonna drop there's just a minor subtlety that as soon as you put an inflaton on a brain, nothing looks as static as this picture looks. There's a back reaction, you have to take it into account, the geometry changes, but the net result, I will just skip over that, the net result is easy to anticipate in its crudest form, and then I'll write down the calculation. The crudest form is that this heavy field sigma is now replaced by a tensor field, the Kaluza-Klein graviton, the heavy graviton. And it looks just like the picture we looked at before, and so you get the answer that we looked at before, except it's interesting. This is one of the things that Arkani Ahmed and Maldacena pointed out, is that even the spin information, the spin of the heavy particle, shows up in this angular dependence between the soft and the hard momentum. And so other than that, this looks just like the kind of vanilla thing I showed you before. But if you plug in the numbers, because these are Planck, that scale lambda is now Planck suppression, you find that the non-Gaussianity going rate looks very small. And so we at least have to, we have to keep in mind how small that is, and I'll get to that in 1 second, like what is a reasonable thing to talk about. But just to say, if you do a more refined calculation, then you get F in this form. The Planck suppression is just written in terms of R, which is the scalar, the tensor to scalar ratio that is constrained by Planck to be, 0.1-ish. Here is that angular thing I talked about. This is some dressed up version. Since mu, for large m at least, mu would just be m. This is secretly just some version of the Boltzmann suppression. This is that k soft over k hard to the im thing I talked about. And the three halves is really just the redshifting of massive fields. If you square this amplitude, you'd get k soft over k hard cubed. These are secretly keeping track of time, so it's really the redshifting of scalar matter like 1 over scale factor cubed, okay? But here it is plotted out. In terms of the going rate FNLs, as a function of mass, and you can see it's dropping precipitously because of Boltzmann suppression, you'd have to really be lucky, and then you might see an FNL of order 0.1.
Why is FNL a good comparison? Because that's on the equilateral triangle.
It is, and so on top of that, you have to squeeze. So you have to have extra room for, like,
so
this.
Squeezing it makes it even smaller.
It does because of this, well, at least in this power law way. So you're in a desperate game because you want to squeeze at least a little bit so that you are able to see the non-analytic dependence that this thing represents. You don't want to squeeze too much because this 3/2 starts hurting.
I see.
But this is why I want to say it's super exciting, except you're playing such a desperate game. That's the
question. So maybe I got confused. So I thought K1 was the small momentum and K3 was larger.
No. I think this K3 is soft. This is the hard one.
But may I also ask, so when you say you treat a kind of back reaction more carefully, do you include the modulus that kind of
presents? Yeah, that's like the whole story is that regarding that modulus. You have to stabilize the extra dimension.
Right.
It's an amusing thing in the sense that when you have an extra dimension and you have an inflaton on a brain, again, intuitively, the inflaton the de Sitter space has a Hawking temperature. And there's a funny way in which the Hawking temperature can burn. If the temperature is too high, it can burn the extra dimension in the following sense. If you try to lower the mass of the KK graviton so you're not so killed by Boltzmann suppression, that's like saying that this is a larger space, then, or the Kaluza-Klein scale is smaller, then this Hawking temperature back reacts and puts a black horizon or extended horizon in front of the other boundary. And if you ask, like, what's the temperature of this black horizon? Well, it's the Hawking temperature. It's equilibrated. Okay. So it's a strange thing. Anyway, you have to make sure that doesn't happen. And so all the results, we study that carefully, and all the results, I'm telling you, these results are consistent with that.
You need a potential or something to stabilize.
Yes, so we had a simple Goldberger-wise, like, stabilization, yeah.
So the mass of the modulus is dependent on, okay.
Yeah, the mass of the modulus is dependent on how close you go to the edge where you would have had the black brain instead. So it can be small. In fact, in some limit, you get the discrete Kaluza-Klein tower collapses into a continuum. So then this modulus loses its meaning.
But how is the mass compared to the other fields you
have? It is lighter. The Goldberger-Wise field is lighter than the Kaluza-Klein graviton, but comparable, but it is not. So it's something you could try to look for in the cosmological collider physics. It's obscured by two things. One is that the lighter the mass, the easier it is to fake with other contributions to non-Gaussianity. And of course, it's not as distinctive as the spin 2 guy at spin 0. Yeah.
And the potential doesn't change your inflaton potential? So
yeah, it changes a lot. So we had to study, there's a kind of a coupled, that's what made this a hard project, which is there's a kind of a coupled problem. You have the geometric back reaction, and coupled to that is this scalar Goldberger-Wise back reaction, and you have to solve the coupled problem. So I'm not sure.
Is it multi-field inflation? So is it lighter than Hubble? And then this model's mass?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So it's multi-field. So you will get some kind of local Gaussianity, just normal one, yeah?
Only if that reheats. I mean, there is a light. It is a light field, but it does not have to reheat the standard model or anything like that.
Robin, the reason why I care about the graviton over the other KK mode is because of what?
Yeah, so we wanted to do both. So I'm showing you first the thing that is bizarre and that requires less discussion, which is it's spin 2. So it's already a weird thing to suddenly show up. But we can also study the gauge boson, what about the heavy gauge bosons, right?
So the amplitude of the other ones are higher or smaller?
They're smaller for reasons I'm going to go into. Yeah, you see, this was already Planck suppressed.
Okay.
And so the answer to your question is really both. There's kind of a vanilla model, which in some way that I'm telling you, the vanilla mechanism, and then the answer is it's smaller. The gauge boson is a very tough thing to find. But there are variants, which is the other things we developed, which allow it to be as strong or stronger than the graviton. So, but you have to wait, you have to see that. Okay, so this one, I had to choose which battles to fight. This, I'm just gonna say it, but it would take too long to explain. Of course, it would be great if not only to look, use this to, we're using inflationary physics to probe other particle physics, but it'd be interesting if we could also probe inflation in this way. So at least in my research, I've been taken by the fact that inflation itself, getting inflationary potentials, either single field or multi-field, it always poses a kind of naturalness problem. You can't just say I have a approximately flat potential because I need something to end and reheat and so on. So especially in, if you're going for a low scale inflation, then the fine tuning problems in some sense get harder. So there are various naturalness problems associated with writing an inflationary theory, but there are also ways of solving those naturalness problems, borrowing from particle physics hierarchy problem mechanisms with new symmetries. So the most famous one is supersymmetry, in which case the superpartner of the inflaton would be the so-called synflaton. And you could ask, could that possibly be a target of cosmological collider physics? And that's something that was not the purpose of our paper. That was just the last thing in our paper. But we were studying here supersymmetric inflation. And indeed, there's a very reasonable part of the parameter space in which the synflaton would have the mass and couplings to show itself in cosmological collider physics. You can also use discrete symmetries inspired by the work on twin Higgs theories in particle physics, where you're sort of doing variants of hybrid inflation. And the idea that you could, in hybrid inflation, that you could see this heavy waterfall field is would be really interesting if you could see it. That typically would not work in the standard cosmological collider physics that I've been talking about up till now because it's too heavy. It would just be too Boltzmann suppressed. But for something I'll mention in a minute, you could do it. So I at least want to say there's at least the ambition of probing inflation directly in this way. OK, so now something about, well, it's very hard to know which things to say first in this talk and which things to say second. But we got to talk about how precise is precise enough to get away with measuring any of these things. Yeah.
Ask a zero-level question. So it's very clear from these different explanations why there's a maximum mass of what you can probe. If your inflationary scales to the 12 GeV, why can't I look for 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7 GeV type things?
Yeah, so if you go for lighter masses, this thing that looks, you see the critical exponent in these correlators looks like IM or something like that, right? And when the M, it's in Hubble units, when the M becomes small, the distinctive feature is lost. So it's not that it doesn't, can't contribute even, but there are other, instead of an inflaton interaction mediated by long-range propagation, long-time propagation, you can have contact interactions of the inflaton, which would look exactly the same. Mm. So it'd be hard to distinguish what you're seeing, right? So there's a golden zone.
So that it's really getting that mediating particle on shell, essentially.
Yeah.
So if it's too light, it's not on shell, forget about it.
I guess, I don't know if I would say it's not on shell, but it's at least not distinctive. Sorry, it looks as good as off-shell.
Yeah.
Okay, so one slide on precision, although this would really take up everything, I mean, in terms of the enterprise. We're only calculating quantum expectations, which means that formally we have to repeat to compare with data, we should run the experiment in many universes, but we only have one. But fortunately, there are many equivalent, like if I want to measure that correlator in the sky, there are many equivalent versions of it based on rotational invariance and even the rescaling that we think is an approximate symmetry. And so that allows us to count many ways of measuring the same observable. And in that way, you can count sort of how many accessible modes any particular experiment or data set has, and you can get a kind of crude error on FNL, the going rate non-Gaussianity, based on its going rate thing, which is the FNL. I'm using units in like the maximal non-Gaussianity we could have ever expected before we ever looked at our universe, 10 to the 4, and then the square root of the number of modes. And so these are the different kinds of data that are already things that we can think about. There is the CMB. This is just looking in terms of redshift. So there's the CMB, and the main thing to see is it's a two-dimensional map. And so we're not really doing three-dimensional wave numbers. We're doing multipoles in a two-dimensional map, spherical harmonics in a two-dimensional map. And if you basically count the number of modes and the precision that buys you, it's roughly the delta FNL of 10, which is the sort of Planck bound that I was telling you about earlier on non-Gaussianity. Large-scale structure, this part here, which happened very late in the universe, is a three-dimensional map. That is actually some thickness. That's a three-dimensional map. And basically, this is the most imminent thing time-wise, would in principle allow us to get down to delta FNLs of order 1. So that's a number to keep in mind as we go forward. And the highly futuristic 21 centimeter high redshift cosmology accesses, well, you see why it's so exciting, okay? And we could talk about FNLs down to 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. And again, I stress, although I won't go into it because I'm not an expert, all of these things, to realize these kind of error bars would require some incredibly brilliant amount of removing all the things that have happened since inflation down to that level. But these are the things that it would at least be in the regime that we call linear. When you're counting modes, you don't want to count modes at short enough distances that all hell is broken loose in, like, galaxies are formed and so on in the modern universe.
So this is all purely linear.
Yeah, this is in the linear regime where you're trying to gauge how much that is. Just to say, linear doesn't mean that to get the precision you need, you might need to calculate to several orders in nonlinearities, but small nonlinearities. Okay, so obviously a huge target of any kind of, like, I'm going to look at really high collider energies would be, well, why not look for gauge and Higgs theories, the kind of grammar that we know and love. So one thing is just charge. If things carry gauge charges, then there's the little issue of charge conservation. So here is the prototypical diagram where you have a massive charge particle. But if charge is conserved, then it appears in a loop. And at least we have to pay the loop suppression price, whatever that is. And we have to diagnose, you know, we have to kind of figure out what we're looking at when we see something. So what we did a few years ago was to just say, well, what about after Higgsing? After all, you could have a Higgs, there could be a Higgs out there, and you could Higgs something. Then the particle that's in here could actually show up at tree level as long as it's a neutral particle. Post-Higgsing, it becomes neutral. What do I mean by that? For example, the Z0 contains part of the SU2W boson, the third component of the W boson, which has got an SU2 charge. But after Higgsing, it's just neutral. Okay? It's neutral under the only remaining gauge theory force there is, electromagnetism. So then this becomes a possibility. And so we wanted to study this option, where everything was still got that tree-level simplicity and diagnosability and size. So that leads to this mechanism, which we called heavy lifting, which is a very strange way, potentially, of probing naturalness. Because you have access to these very high energies, and you could ask what's going on with the standard model at these very high energies. So imagine that this is the Higgs of the standard model. I've used little h because capital H is reserved for the Hubble parameter. Okay, so this is the Higgs doublet. There it is. This is the usual wine bottle potential. This is the tachyonic mass. But because I'm a theory of curved spacetime, it is natural to have an order 1 coupling of this dimension 2 h dagger h to the dimension 2 Ricci scalar curvature. Okay, and now if we ask, well, what is that doing? If that coupling was there, what's it doing today? Well, the answer is nothing, because that Ricci scalar is the Hubble scale today, and that's zip, so forget about it. But back then, this Hubble scale could be, you know, whatever, 10 to the 13 GeV, 10 to the 10 GeV. And that means that this is giving a huge correction to the electroweak scale that we normally see it in today's temperatures. This is actually a sneaky version of the naturalness problem. It says that the electroweak scale is incredibly unnatural. The slightest change in conditions in environment, and suddenly it shoots up to incredibly high values. But normally we call that a problem and we work really hard to solve the hierarchy problem as particle physicists. Here we are going to embrace it, or at least test it, by saying, yeah, maybe there is no hierarchy problem, it's all philosophy, forget about it. But here it matters, it will matter, and that something like this would say, we wanted to study the case where it remains tachyonic. Okay, so that's the plus sign, I guess. So it is just taking this tachyonic potential, but instead of being weak scale, it moves it to 10, you know, Hubble scale. In that case, you can see what happens is all the mass scales generated by the Higgs mechanism shoot up to inflationary scales. Mass ratios are determined by gauge couplings and Yukawa couplings. Those are natural couplings, so they are not easy to perturb in this way. So it's just an overall rescaling of the kind of fundamental particle masses. Which means that, to David's question earlier, what if a particle was lighter than the Hubble scale and couldn't I see the standard model? Well, no, you couldn't, but now you can because the masses of these particles are in the golden window of Hubble, right? Great, so here is the, again, that's feel theoretically very nice, but what's the size of the dam signals, okay? So if you use, so the basic idea is, if you want to see something like a Z, or a Z prime, I don't care which one, if you want to see something which is Z-like in the sense that it's neutral after Higgsing, and you want to couple it to inflatons, because of the dangling Lorentz invariance, you have to work with these very high, and you want some sort of shift symmetry, you'd have to work with these rather high dimension operators that look like this. And even that, you could say, well, that's easy to do. I just have some lower dimension operators with some sort of mediator particles that sew it together to look like this. And those particles could have masses of order Hubble themselves. So that's okay, so we can do that. But even then, it's a tight game. Because the net scale lambda here, you see, we're doing effective field theory, and we don't want to invoke non-renormalizable couplings, which would get strong below phi dot. Phi dot, remember, is, or the square root of phi dot is like 60 Hubble. So we want at least to think about effective field theories that make sense all the way up to 60 Hubble. Before the non-renormalizability tells you you've got a UV completed. So that tells you that this suppression on the scale of Hubble, this is a suppression. And that's what makes these signals so small. Whether you do standard gauge theory or even this orbifold gut gauge boson, when you do it, there's good news and bad news. The good news is, again, there's a kind of characteristic angular dependence that tells you that it's spin one. So that's nice. But the bad news is, again, you're down at these very small FNLs, well below what you could ever get, for example, from large-scale structure. Maybe if you're very lucky, on the cusp of what you could do with throwing everything we have at it, okay? So before I address that little problem quickly, I will just say, but look at what you could gain if you could. You could see, you know, you could do some loop processes. You could see all of the heavy particles of the standard model in this sort of way. Here I've told you, I've written down, playing by those effective field theory rules, that, yeah, the price is that these are really tiny. So think like a string theorist, which is, I don't care. I just look at the function, right? And then you'd say, wow, that's so exciting, because all you'd have to do is measure the mass ratios that you're getting from cosmological collider physics and the spins, and you would say, that's odd. All these ratios of strange particles in the sky are matching up the ratio of masses of the standard model that I've seen at colliders. And it wouldn't be quite right, because these couplings would have to be, the ones you see in the sky would be these gauge couplings and Yukawa couplings run up to the Hubble scale. So there would be a little calculation you'd do, but it would be reflective of the RG effects. And if you saw that, if you could see that, you'd say, ah, the standard model, nothing comes in to save it all the way up to that high scale, right? So it would be an amazing test of naturalness or unnaturalness to see such a thing. And but of course, you have to be able to see it, okay?
Can I ask you a question about the previous slide where you write down the couplings? So the inflaton, I mean, the thing that seeds the structure is a coupled mode of the inflaton and the graviton, or not the graviton, but the field, right?
Yeah.
The Mukhanov mode.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, does it matter? I mean, suppose that your fields just coupled to the metric and didn't directly interact with the inflaton, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Would that still induce couplings of the kind that you're assuming here? And so this is just a kind of phenomenological coupling Lagrangian that would...
Yeah, although I think so. I think some version of those couplings might do it. I'd have to think if there's anything that stops it. But it would be very likely to be much more suppressed than these ones. It's easier to couple to the inflaton than to couple to gravity, unless you have, you know, very high curve, high, you know, some power of curvature.
I see. So the coupling to gravity part, which is always there.
It's always there.
How important.
The minimal coupling is always there.
Right, but it would be subdominant compared to a direct coupling.
Exactly.
And then once you form this Mukhanov mode, does that, it just sort of inherits the coupling?
It does, exactly. So in the approximation that we're working, yeah, that inherited thing is exactly the size that I'm already giving, yeah.
Thanks.
So there's a question of seeing it. Of course, there could be other dark sector gauge theories out there, and they could also get heavy lifted into the sites of this cosmological collider in a similar way. So it'd be great to see, but the vanilla model doesn't do it. I'll just say, since I'm running out of time, the simple idea that we had, which could allow you within effective field theory to have signals that are observable for that kind of physics that I just talked about, is based on the so-called curviton variant of inflation. And that's just observing the following thing, that in standard inflation and standard quantum inflation, the inflaton plays two roles. One, it's driving, its vacuum energy is creating a de Sitter phase. And two, its quantum fluctuations are seeding, are decay, after it decays into the standard model, are giving rise to the standard model inhomogeneities, right? So two functions. But you can divide that task into two, and it can quite naturally happen. It's not a very artificial thing, that the inflaton drives inflation. It's doing this classical job of just driving inflation. Whereas it could be some other light field whose quantum fluctuations and which decays into the standard model and whose quantum fluctuations are larger than the inflatons, or at least is driving the coupling to, is the thing that's reheating the standard model. But when those two functions are separated, so this chi is now this curviton, its chi dot does not have to be 60 Hubble squared. It can be of order Hubble squared, okay? And naturally is. In the effective field theory, that means that the non-renormalizable couplings do not have to be suppressed by 60 Hubble, they can be suppressed by just a few Hubble, okay? So within effective field theory, it is possible to repeat the kind of gauge theory exercise I talked about. And then you find, if you're just looking like what's the best that can happen, I'm not trying to sell this, I'm just saying what is possible within effective field theory, then things look healthier in the sense that you're this kind of Higgs mediated, even a loop of Higgses, top quarks, Zs, and so on, are all things that have FNLs that are at least possible to see in the future. Okay. And I think I will just say this and stop. I wanted to talk about gravitational waves, which is actually the more recent thing, but let me just stop with this. This idea that the curviton is addressing the question of the strength of the signals by addressing the scale that is showing up in couplings, the non-renormalizable couplings. Of course, that's not helping with the Boltzmann suppression, which is giving us this rather small regime. And the idea of this chemical potential idea is, again, a clever observation that helps with that. So again, the idea of radiative stability of this Goldstone-like inflaton, whose potential is very flat, and so it's, you want to treat it to protect that flatness, you want couplings to it to have derivatives of the inflaton times operators made with heavy particles. The simplest case of that is when there's just one derivative. We've been looking at two derivatives coupled to a heavy particle, but you can have one derivative coupled to a heavy current, a current made out of heavy particles. And what's interesting there is that just the classical piece of this is the phi dot, classical, which then in the Hamiltonian multiplies the charge density of this heavy field, and that looks like a chemical potential. The word chemical potential becomes more meaningful when you remember that the entire production mechanism that we've been talking about is similar-ish in some way to just thermal equilibrium, and Boltzmann suppression is the thing we've been fighting, but with a chemical potential, that's something that can fight Boltzmann suppression. And just for, again, for effective field theory control, this lambda that shows up here, since this has to be dimension three, this lambda that shows up here is constrained to be bigger than the phi dot scale. Or if you want, the effective chemical potential, which I've called lambda, since other things are called mu, the effective chemical potential called little lambda can be no bigger than 60 Hubble, but that's quite an assistance in overcoming Boltzmann suppression. So this general philosophy has been applied, we were not the first to invent it, for non-zero spins of various heavy particles, but we looked at the case of spin zero, which turns out to be, this, from what I can tell, the simplest to understand, the most powerful, and the most robust of all of these mechanisms. Basically, if you have a complex scalar of heavy fields or two real scalar fields, then you have a current that is made out of these complex fields. That's a double arrow derivative, and it could just as well be a regular partial derivative. And the effect of this coupling to the gradient of phi is most easily seen by doing a kind of reparameterization, a field redefinition, where, to say it quickly, in any operator that you write where you don't respect the rephasing symmetry of sigma, the inflaton, after this redefinition, the inflaton multiplies it in this phase factor form, and you can break that phi up into the classical piece, which is just a kind of phi dot times time, this chemical potential-like effect, and then some fluctuations. And just to show you what the effect is, when you have couplings with time-dependent couplings, right? When you effectively have time-dependent couplings, and the time dependence is in the form of a high frequency, lambda. Lambda is much bigger than Hubble. Then time-dependent couplings can create particles. That's just a standard field theory fact. And so when you do the simplest exercise of this type, I won't explain in greater detail, you get things like this that you could hope to see. So this is the non-Gaussianity. I've removed the sort of automatic matter dilution effect, right? Just so that it looks like simple pictures. And the Fs are sort of order, in this picture, order 1 to 0.1. And here is a function of squeezing. And what you're looking at for masses as big as 30 Hubble or 5 Hubble, and for large chemical potential, what you're seeing is, if you think of this as time, it literally is the heavy field propagating in time back in those days. Okay, so it really is very much like seeing the quantum particle propagating. This is perhaps the easiest case where you can see it without getting killed by too small a size.
And it was a perfect picture. What sets lambda in? Sorry.
Yeah, so lambda is set by this. Oh, wait, one more. It's a non-renormalizable coupling of this type. And so this phi dot over lambda, but the lambda itself has to be smaller than the phi dot scale. Yeah. Okay, so I think I want to stop with, but so I will just say what I've actually been doing in the more recent times, last year and so on, is really the power of this whole approach is, theoretically, it's just incredible. It's totally mind-boggling. Every time I replay it to myself, I'm like, that's just so amazing. It's got to be something we could take advantage of in the real world. And yet you see that cosmic variance, the fact that we only have these maps, that the number of modes in each map is finite, infrared cutoff is the size of the universe, ultraviolet is where you lose track of being able to calculate what's going on, nonlinearities in these modes. So there's a question, are there other maps that, beyond the standard model maps of primordial fluctuations that we could take advantage of, and which might have improved cosmic variance? They might have other problems for humans, but in terms of physical limitations, they might not have the same physical limitations. And that's sort of where I got into the stochastic gravitational wave stuff. I think I've taken too much of your time, so I'm gonna stop and take questions. Yeah, thanks. John?
Yes, so how do you explain the classification of quantum fluctuations? This problem relates to understanding the primordial fluctuation spectrum, and also the fact that quantum fluctuations push inflation into eternal inflation, which gets you into a multiverse situation. Because the classification is somehow is a measurement problem. How do you explain this?
So I say at one end, the easier end to answer you would be on the eternal inflation front, which is, this is a very kind of local analysis. We don't ask, or what I'm not doing is, I'm not asking, is inflation a reasonable theory in a global sense for why we see the world looking the way it looks? I don't ask that. I say, it's got a local kind of attractor form to it. As if you start in the ballpark of inflation, then inflation drives you towards a flat universe without a standard, you know, with a uniform CMB and all of that. And what happens if I go far into our future, or where this came from, far in our past or far sideways into the next horizon? I don't ask because I'm too dumb. I don't know how to deal with the problems and the measure issues of eternal inflation. I don't know how to do it. In terms of quantum fluctuations, I think that, again, is easy in the sense that maybe the easiest way to say it is the way I have been alluding to it, that there is a kind of Hawking temperature, which is a kind of quasi-useful concept in this game. And the Hawking temperature says that, yes, you have particle creation. Where you have a temperature, you have particle creation.
I think John was asking about the quantum fluctuations becoming classical.
How is it effectively measured?
And I would have thought your answer is just that you're just looking at expectation values of products of operators.
Indeed.
Just measuring average values,
yeah,
that are predicted by the theory.
Exactly. And that the thing that's easiest to calculate are the quantum expectations. And you have to ask, well, how are you comparing them to data? And that's the thing I explained, that even though we only have one universe, we have, for any given observable, we have multiple equivalent measurements using rotational and translational invariance and scale invariance.
It has to be decoherence. You have to decohere because of the environment.
See, the environment here is all courtesy of quantum fluctuations itself, right? Like, there's no other environment but this inflating. So if you want, the vacuum I'm calculating, or the state I'm calculating these in-in correlators in, is the Bunch-Davies vacuum. And when we make a measurement, like we look at our universe today, we get one. So let's say that's the way in which I'm collapsing the wave function. I just look today, I see the universe as it is. It's not homogeneous, it doesn't look like that in detail, but taking these averages over the sky of different triangles in the sky is how I'm getting something that I can then compare to the quantum average. There is a sense, which maybe is what your question is, which is that operationally there's a sense in which when modes exit the horizon, there's a sense in which they are effectively measured. But I don't need to speak in that way. I think I can speak in the way Ted said, which is, I measure things today, damn it, and that's it.
It's the pity that dust has blocked us from seeing primordial gravitational waves, because we can't see really what's happening with reflection. So far, the dust has blocked.
The dust has blocked.
Dust.
Yeah.
Blocked our observation.
Yeah, and I should say that this gravitational wave was different from the...
I want to get rid of the dust.
Yeah, that, I mean, for the B-mode type.
B-mode.
Yeah, yeah. Those are gravitational waves from inflation. This was going to be about gravitational waves from phase transitions, but put that aside.
I have a question that seems really important that you didn't mention. So you sort of look case by case at different scenarios, different types of hypothetical particles,
yeah.
Heavy lifting, all kinds of effects could produce signals.
Yeah.
Each one has its own particular, you know,
type. Yeah.
Features. The real universe may have several of those things,
yeah,
going on,
yeah,
all at once, and all of those oscillations and features would be piled on top of each other.
Yes.
So what would be the net result of piling,
yeah, yeah,
on top of each,
so,
other?
We did think about this a little bit, and here's where the bad news becomes good news to some extent. So worst case, they are piled up on top of each other, and diagnosing what you're seeing would be a nightmare, and you might actually see something, and
that's what I meant. Would,
yeah,
you even see anything, or would,
yeah,
it just be indistinguishable from some other kind of noise?
Yeah, I think if it was totally overcrowded, then maybe it's indistinguishable in some way. The one good thing is that this Boltzmann suppression, this fact that there's a kind of window, means that, yeah, typically some guy might be of order Hubble, but it's so easy to miss the window. And so this narrow window allows you to, in some sense, have more likely that you see zero things or one thing rather than 10 things or two things. But in the case where you have this broader window with chemical potentials, that issue at least comes up, but it requires some special features for that kind of current coupling. So again, you can hope, I mean, the bad story you're telling could happen, but it's, after a little thought, it's not the direction I'm most worried about. I'm most worried about not catching anything in the fish net.
Yeah. While we're asking those kind of questions, maybe a related one is that, you know, you showed this benchmark of delta FNL, which is just the size of the equilateral triangle three-point function. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay, so fine. So we can measure that to be 1 or 10 to the minus 4. But really, in order to see this non-analyticity of this part propagating, you're essentially doing a shape analysis,
yeah,
of that thing, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you're changing the triangle shape, and as a function,
yeah,
of the triangle shape,
yes,
you're watching this thing go,
yes,
into this, like, into this dip or into this. I mean, I guess you can literally,
yeah,
plot it as a function, this ratio.
Yeah, yeah.
You
so
see some shape,
so you see,
right,
in the best case, which is why I actually, you know, when I actually show something as a function of squeezing, I show you this picture, which came from the chemical potential mechanism. And there you're actually saying, yeah, yeah, there is this little drop off here by an order of magnitude over an order of magnitude. But look, wow,
right,
you're really, you know, you're seeing something.
Right.
Now, without the chemical potential enhancement,
right,
in the vanilla model,
right,
then it's sort of like just seeing, you know, that,
right?
Right?
Right.
And it's,
right,
and life is really hard,
right,
which is why I'm pointing out, there's the string theory take on this talk, which is to hell with the real world, but look, it's so cool. And then there's the pragmatic one, where you might still be trying to say, well, oh, I am at least seeing something that's consistent with non-analyticity, and I can still maybe fit and say that it's this fuzzy notion of a mass. Or you have to have one of these enhanced. That's why I'm so interested in these various enhancement mechanisms, whether it's curvaton enhancement, chemical potential, looking for new maps where the data set would be larger and there's less cosmic variance. It's just this incredible mechanism, but looking for a real world implementation where you can max out on what you would like it to have. Yeah. It's like having a great new collider without Methuselah added to it. You know, it would just not be any fun at all. So.
It's sort of along the lines of the last two questions. Has anyone gone and calculated tau NL or two FNL functions? The correlation of like two two-point functions. I think it would look like you actually close the loop on delta phi twice. You would, instead of sending one of your delta phis to like an expectation value, you would actually just.
So I don't know are you saying the trispectrum, the four-point function, or
no? It's not quite the trispectrum, because the trispectrum would be like three insertions of the implanton. This would be like the correlation of two double insertions of the implanton or something like that. It would be like the correlation of two FNLs. So it's sometimes called tau NL, so it's not quite.
I'm not familiar with the phrase tau NL, but I'm also not clear what Feynman diagram you're pointing to. There's two FNLs.
Yeah, yeah.
And now what do you want to do with...
Oh, yeah, just put these your heavy field between them. So instead...
Like this?
Yeah, so... No. So you've got the one blue triangle up, just like up there right now.
Yeah.
And just put another one right next to it, and then just have sigma connect those two. So you would no longer... I mean, you didn't put it in this diagram,
it's
but you...
It's a four-point function.
Yeah, it would be a four-point function.
A four-point function, yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think you would get a suppression that would go like another power.
Yeah. But are you tracking the time dependent? In other words, the beauty of the three-point function... is that minimally it allows you to have two times, and so you have two times pegged and you can watch something propagate from there to there.
Yeah.
When in the thing you're talking about, you're still going to have two times?
Yeah, you can have two times by varying sort of the absolute difference between them.
Yeah,
lines.
Yeah. So, there are...
That's trispectral. That's just trispectrum.
It goes under the name of trispectrum, but there are two trispectrum shapes. There's like GNL, which would be...
Yeah. But okay, so broadly, it's got the sort of four-point function thing. Yeah. So there are signals that would show up there too. In a typical situation, it would show up here more easily than it would show up in a trispectrum. There can be specific models in which things don't show up at three-point and only then show up at four-point. So those would be amusing. I already feel, since I at least pretend to be a phenomenologist, I feel like I'm already gone too far by talking about any of this physics because of the sheer desperation of the experimental situation, which is not absolutely, the way I like to calm myself is to say, it's like 50 years ago when somebody said, hell, maybe we actually could measure gravitational waves, right? And everybody laughed. So that's a bit like how I feel, but I don't want to go any further. But mathematically, I'm on your side. I should at least say one thing, because it's so cartoon level, that basically. During phase transition, if a phase transition happens in the very early universe, way earlier than the CMB, and the phase transition, first order phase transitions, as you may know, are a powerful source of gravitational waves. So the gravitational waves are to the phase transition what CMB photons are to the CMB. They're just the messenger. But they could be anisotropies, just like there's anisotropies in the cosmic soup of the CMB that give rise to the anisotropies in the CMB that we observe, anisotropies in the cosmic soup that undergoes the phase transition would have anisotropies in the gravitational wave stochastic map. Gravitational waves are hard to see, but look at the physical limits. The physical limits, by happening so early, many modes that thaw by the time they hit the CMB, they thaw so much that we are not even able to calculate them, or they're completely damped away by silk damping. In a very early phase transition, all those modes that we would ever see on the sky would actually still be frozen at the time of the phase transition. So they would be uncorrupted by re-entering the horizon. And so in the in principle data set, is enormous. The set of modes that's in principle hidden in the gravitational wave background is ginormous. And then the entire challenge is the practicality of detecting gravitational waves with sufficient precision and removing foregrounds from astrophysics.
About, you were mentioning like bubble formation.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah, exactly.
Inhomogeneity.
No. Sorry, it was crucial that the analogy was that just like the CMB. If I really zoom in, I'll see little atoms here and there, and I could say, well. Oh, so that's not homogeneous, but that's not what you mean. You're really talking about the superhorizon modes of inhomogeneity. So similarly here, the bubble collisions are taking place on, you know, roughly speaking, that scale, right? And that's not the inhomogeneity I'm talking about. I'm saying that since, let's just, the northern hemisphere of the universe is colder than the southern hemisphere of the universe because of some quantum fluctuation during inflation, right? That means that the northern hemisphere undergoes the phase transition earlier than the southern hemisphere. The gravitational waves from the northern hemisphere are therefore harder than, they're redder than the gravitational waves in the southern hemisphere. But it's not the anisotropy on the scale of the bubbles itself. That's hopeless to ever see.
So wait, I guess I don't understand. What during the phase transition generates the gravitational waves?
The bubble collisions. Very much like it is sort of, you know, whatever, atomic and ion physics that produces individual photons of the CMB.
Think of it like boiling water and...
You should think of it as like boiling.
A stochastic distribution.
Yeah. But we're averaging over that. In other words, we don't have the sensitivity to see that bubble collision there and that bubble collision there.
Right.
Maybe the easy...
There's a really characteristic spectrum shape. Just like the black body for CMB, there's some like hydrodynamics, blah blah, Russian shape of the gravitational waves from the bubble collisions, and it just shifts the central frequency. That's kind of the you're looking for shifts in the central frequency.
Yeah, I think the analogy that might be easy. So there's the spectral information, which is super important, but not part of my work, part of his work. Think of it more like. Star mergers, which is the standard way, black hole mergers, whatever it is, the usual way that we see gravitational waves right now. If we are seeing with powerful new detectors gravitational waves from many, many, many mergers in the universe, they might each be unresolvable. They're so far away that they give us a stochastic distribution. So I'm not even trying to see that, oh, there's a merger there, there's no merger there. It's all fuzzed out. However, it may be, in fact, it is true, that large-scale structure has high and low densities. So the northern hemisphere may be a higher average density than the southern hemisphere, which means that the number of star mergers happening from the north and the number from the south will be different. That's the anisotropy I'm talking about.
Just a dipole?
No, that was just the one I could say with my hands. Quadrupole, octupole, multipoles, yeah. Low multipoles, but not such high multiples as to actually angularly resolve, that's the merger, oh, there's empty space, that's the, you see, that's all like grains of sand.
I'm confused. So there are two signals. One is just a stochastic distribution that has a certain characteristic spectrum, and another is global anisotropy.
Yeah, so there are two axes, frequency spectrum, angular spectrum, if you want. So just like the CMB, the frequency spectrum is black body. And the angular spectrum is the one that you see on the wallpaper outside our seminar room, right? So here, the frequency spectrum is not black body. It actually has real exciting information about the particle physics of the phase transition. But there's still an angular distribution. And that's the thing I'm talking about. The frequency spectrum tells us about the physics of this era. The angular power spectrum, the angular spectrum, tells us about the physics of this era, whatever is imprinting the fluctuations on very large angles.
The current evidence for stochastic inflation, stochastic gravitational waves, is marginal. Less than 3 seconds.
That we have any.
We don't know there is stochastic gravitational waves.
I would say, yeah, we don't, until we hear more from this nanograv thing that you are saying is rumored, we don't have any evidence of stochastic gravitational waves. But we may. I mean, the whole idea is new detectors, space-based detectors, and so on, are in the right ballpark for seeing gravitational waves from roughly TV phase transitions.
So let's thank Ramani.